88 to 91.
Radio 2.
On February the 4th, 1977, an album was released that would reshape the music scene forever. The making of this record was fraught from day one. The cast of characters played out a soap opera script that you would hardly dare to write. But what came out of those sessions would go on to be one of the best-selling albums of all time. I'm Paul Sexton. This is The Story of Rumours.
We knew the soap opera was there, but we didn't know how clear it was to everyone else.
Never once did I, as the mother hen, of thinking, oh my God, it's all going to blow up and someone's going to walk out and we'll never finish this album.
I didn't know if Lindsay and I were going to make it. I didn't know if Fleetwood Mac was going to make it. I mean, I'm not a soothsayer. You can go your own way.
Throughout all this turmoil, the band, they had to somehow get it together and persevere because they knew this album meant so much.
Even though everything was going wrong around us, somehow the music was great. There were really good times interspersed with the band.
By 1977, Fleetwood Mac were already a band with one hell of a history. Formed a decade earlier by bass guitarist John McVie and drummer Mick Fleetwood, both refugees from John Mayall's Blues Breakers. At the turn of the 70s, as the band tried to deal with the mental undoing of genius guitarist Peter Green, John's then-wife Christine came in on keyboards, along with guitarist Bob Welsh. With a sense of timing he's been ribbed about ever since, and how he must love that, Welsh left in 1974, and the duo of guitarist Lindsey Buckingham and vocalist Stevie Nicks joined for Fleetwood Mac's eponymous album, often affectionately known as the White Album. The humdrum sales and declining prestige of the Fleetwood Mac imprint was about to take a distinct turn for the better, and the group's most commercially successful lineup was born. Stevie Nicks.
I was aware of a band called Fleetwood Mac that had a lady singer in it named Christine McVie. And I was very interested in that due to the fact that there just really weren't that many bands with women singers that were up front. So that was about as aware of Fleetwood Mac as I was. And when I came in contact with them, I instantly went out and bought all their records. Lindsay was going back and forth with should we or should we not break up Buckingham Nicks. We decided that the best thing for the both of us was Fleetwood Mac, and Fleetwood Mac really didn't need another lady singer, needless to say, but Lindsay wasn't going to go into Fleetwood Mac without me, and they knew that. So it was like, we need a guitar player, and this is a great guitar player. And we don't really need another girl singer, but she happens to be his old lady. Either we take her or we don't get him.
Producer and engineer Ken Collet.
Stevie and Lindsay were just at the right place at the right time. You know, Keith Olsen played Mick Buckingham Nicks tapes just so Keith could show them what Sound City Studios sounded like. And Mick, being the genius he is, heard the unique sounds of the band and put two and two together.
I remember being very impressed with Lindsay's guitar playing.
Mick Fleetwood.
And that was instantly what we were looking for. And I've never been forgiven by Stevie, of course. Well, you weren't looking for a singer, you were looking for a guitar player. And that was that. And learnt that they came very much as a pair. And we met, we did an audition. I played the album, Buckingham Nicks, for John and Chris. And I said, I think these people are incredibly talented. Lindsay's a great guitar player. And I think this should be our next move. It was that clear.
Lindsay Buckingham.
I had to pare down my style, and I had to try to go with the strengths that I had in terms of what I could offer, which was not just about guitar playing, it was about production.
So it was a big change for Lindsay and Stevie, who'd spent 3 years or so working and recording under the name Bucking & Nicks, to join Fleetwood Mac, whose star may have been in The Descendant, but they were still a big name. So how easy was it for these two young musicians to join one of the biggest bands in rock? Here's Mick.
She really gravitated to having another lady to bounce off, and I think she felt a lot of support there. I think it was a slower process for Lindsay because he had so much artistic say and control in how their music really came out.
Piano rings like a bell through the night, and wouldn't she love to love her?
We were all so excited and so grateful. They were grateful that they had found Lindsay, at least, and we were terribly grateful that we had found them. And I was terribly grateful that I didn't have to be a waitress or a cleaning lady anymore. So it was really a pretty much a mutual admiration society at that point.
She not only had to get used to the idea of becoming the new girl in an established band, but also their second female vocalist alongside Christine McVie.
She was awfully nice to me. If she hadn't have liked me, I would have picked it up and then I would have really been unhappy, because I wouldn't have wanted to be in the band then. She and I were all on our own for many years. There was no wardrobe mistresses, no makeup artists, no hairdressers, no anybody. And it was just me and Chris. So we had many years to depend on nobody else but us for female company. She made me feel welcome, so I felt okay.
John McVie.
When we first rehearsed with Lindsay and Stevie in a basement, within the first hour, it's like, this is working. This is excellent. This is going to be great. It just clicked.
Fleetwood Mac had got used to so-so record sales over the previous few years, probably not much more than 250,000 copies all told per album. But the 1975 record just called Fleetwood Mac really upped the ante. 5 million or so sales across a really long shelf life, especially in the States, where it racked up nearly 3 years on the chart all told.
Monday morning, you showed up fine.
But what became a Grammy Award-winning team for the follow-up project was not quite complete. Richard Dashart had been assistant engineer on Lindsay and Stevie's Bucking & Nicks album, and he'd taken up production duties on Rumours. Responsibilities were shared between Richard, Fleetwood Mac themselves, and a new engineer that Richard brought in to help produce the record. He was Ken Kelly, talking here about Richard Dashart.
He was their sound engineer and a real good buddy of them, and he and I hit it off right off the bat. And the band and I hit it off good, and the music worked, and the magic worked, and the next thing I knew, they asked me to do the album. I was young and eager and up and coming, and this thing fell in my lap, and it was like, yeah, this is right, the next thing for me, you know?
Mick Fleetwood had decided they should record away from the distractions of LA, about a 6 or 7 hour drive further up the California coast at a studio called The Record Plant in Sausalito. The setup at The Record Plant featured a number of small recording rooms in a large windowless wooden building.
It was all dark. It was designed to keep police out.
And the planets of the universe go their way.
If police came in, they would be disoriented. It had undulating walls and no parallel surfaces. And, you know, we were in there at 18 hours a day. It was like a little rabbit's maze. And, you know, just added to the dazed and confused people in there. Quite an experience. Quite an experience.
I think it was a good setting for what we were about then.
Lindsay Buckingham.
We were part of a subculture which was engaging in the use of certain substances, you know. We were also looking to get out of L.A., I think, because we thought it would cleanse the palate for what was going on. That didn't really happen. It almost magnified it. It made whatever was going on with us seem to stand out, you know. We put ourselves in an environment which forced us to tap into certain things which might have gotten slightly more glossed over had we been in L.A.
John McVie.
We started off with the best of intentions. A house came with the studio where the lads stayed and the crew. And then all this started coming down. So the working hours sort of went from 26 hours a day, and then it would be 10:30 a.m. That's half an hour before a bar opened in Sausalito called Agatha's. So we used to go down there at 11 and have the Irish coffees and go back to the house, and it would be party time. And then it would be time to crash. And then start all over again. So there wasn't a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. It was a day. So it was a continuous nine-month weekend. But it was just a roll. Succession of studio, daylight, sleep, and whatever it took to get through it.
There were no clocks ticking, that is for sure.
Mick Fleetwood.
Which is a funny part of it. Often, you know, that whole thing of overindulgence in a lot of areas, which, you know, which there was, but it was really all about the music when all is said and done. And then you have the thing, oh my God, and it costs so much money. And for us, it wasn't like a gift. It was our money, and it was our pleasure and our thrill to be able to spend that time and spend fortunes of money getting what we wanted to present to our audience. I think that's rather an honourable thing, but it always amazed me. I'm going like, do you think we're just sitting around wasting time? We're trying to write a book here and make it as great as it can be.
Everything seemed to be going to plan, but then the rumour soap opera was about to take shape. Here's Ken Collet.
I remember one of the first days we were getting our sounds in the studio, and I kind of heard some voices raising behind me. And as I turned around, there was John McVie talking to Christine with John's girlfriend, then Sandra. Christine said, John, why are you getting so jealous? You have your girlfriend, you have Sandra here. They were all three drinking champagne. And John says, oh yeah, well, she means nothing to me. Anyway, Sandra threw a glass of champagne in John's face. So I turned around just to see the champagne flying. And I thought, okay, this is odd.
The only problem with rumors was that we were all breaking up. And that was a big problem. Because when you have to be in a room about this size, from 2 in the afternoon until 4, or 5, or 6, or 7, or 8, or maybe even the next night, it's difficult. So it's difficult not to be bitter. It's difficult not to be somewhat nasty when you react to something that somebody says. That was hard.
Lindsay and Stevie were singing on microphone, you know, You Make Love and Fun or something, side by side doing these harmony parts. They made a mistake or something. We stopped taping. Suddenly they started screaming at each other and just accusing each other of cheating or lying, and I was looking, oh my God. So I tried to rewind the tape as fast as I could. Once I hit play, then they went right back to singing like nothing had ever happened. And then when we stop again, they go back to arguing.
Two couples in a band is unusual enough. Two couples who have broken up, I mean, it's got to be some kind of a recipe for dysfunction. And clearly it was. I mean, the only way we got through that was to compartmentalize our emotions, was to kind of seal off things over here and then get on with what needed to be done in the rest of the room. You know, kind of an exercise in denial on a daily level.
I was at this really unique position of sitting there in the control room watching all this stuff. And throughout all this turmoil, they had to somehow get it together and persevere because they knew this album meant so much. In fact, one of the first days we were in the studio, they got a call from, I think, their manager that said, looks like your first album is really taking off. This means that if you can make this new album that you're working on as good as your old album, two albums, hits in a row, will make you superstars. through the next 12 months, they just got better and better. They put some stuff behind them and kept improving the songs. So it was quite a journey.
With the Fleetwood Mac White album still being promoted by the band and climbing up the charts, it was even more important to make Rumours a hit, which would put Fleetwood Mac in a league of their own. The first track on the album was written by Lindsay.
Secondhand News was considered really a front runner to be the opening track on the album from early on. Itself consists of kind of Scottish, Irish folk influences, and when we first started cutting it, I think we were doing it with something that was a more literal translation of that. In other words, maybe a march time on snare with brushes or some odd thing. But we were also very interested in keeping the pop element, since it was going to be the first song and it was a pop album. So we really opted for more of a dance beat within the confines of what that was. I think I'd even heard Jive Talking by the Bee Gees and pulled a couple of textures from that.
Much of the things that aren't directed don't need to be, and they take care of themselves. John would be a good example of that. Most of the time, he takes his time working out his part. But it's not like you need to discuss what he's going to do. Once in a while, because he's a melodic bass player, you'll ask him to play. I think Secondhand News is a good example of that. I think he wanted to do much more of a traveling part, and I asked him to just play pretty straight eighths on it.
There was some angst there when Lindsay finally said, I'm going to replay the bass and do it my way. And then eventually we had to break the news to John that Lindsay wanted John to do a straight bass instead of a John bass. And I remember John was not thrilled, but eventually he listened to what was there and saw that that was the right thing to do. And I know there was some tension in our part in the control room. Lindsay having to tell John that, and how was that going to go down? Because John started to resent being told what to do by Lindsay, and that was all part of the fun.
As the sessions rolled on, there was a growing collective sense that what they were doing was something quite special. Mick Fleetwood.
I mean, the reality is Fleetwood Mac was still alive and reasonably well. It sold nearly 5 million albums.
I took my love, took it down. I climbed a mountain and I turned around.
We were still sort of reeling from that and really didn't take it all in what it really meant, you know, in terms of success. And we were gloriously green, which kept us innocent and ensconced in our music, I think. It felt like there was certainly an iota of reasonable confidence that someone, for us rather large numbers, was at least going to listen to this next album.
Can I handle the seasons?
The next track on the album was the one rumoured single to make it to number one in America. Dreams was written by Stevie Nicks in precisely 10 minutes. She wrote it during a break in recording at the record plant and played it to the rest of the band. Here's Christine McVie.
Before we recorded Dreams, Stevie played it on the piano, and Stevie is a self-confessed non-musical person when it comes to the piano. She knows four chords, I think. And as Lindsay always says, yes, but they're the right four chords. She played this song to us, and I thought to myself, Well, I don't know, this sounds a little bit tedious to me. It's just going dun ching dun ching dun dun ching ching all the way through the song.
Listen carefully to sound.
Lindsay said, no, this is going to be wonderful. We'll record it, we'll use each section and build each section up differently so that those four chords run all the way through. Actually, I think she only used two or three chords for this one. So even though they are the same three chords, it's not going to sound like it. When we recorded it, that's exactly what happened. It's built up into three separate sections, which, although they're the same chords running through virtually, it doesn't sound at all like it. And it was actually our only number one single, I think, in Fleetwood Mac history.
Ken Calais.
We cut Dreams four times trying to get the right feel because we felt that it needed to be almost hypnotic because it was basically a two-chord song, and we actually eventually wanted the drums to be so consistent that it almost was hypnotic. So to do that, we used a trick called a tape loop at that time. We had Mick play for about 3 minutes, just a straight pattern, and we found the best four bars and cut that out of the tape and glued the beginning of the tape onto the end of the tape and made it into this big loop. Well, about four bars, let's say about 4 seconds of music, was about, I think, 16 feet of tape to run through this tape machine. It was just going to go running through, and then we would play that into another machine just to play this loop to make this consistent 4-minute piece. It took about 5 of us holding big 2-inch tape reels to keep the tension proper on this loop so the tape machine would continue to play and wouldn't stop. So there's 5 of us all standing there and holding these reels. We were looking as this tape is just going around the room like a fan belt would be running around the pulleys in a car, you know. And we stood there for 4 minutes just looking at each other in the room. So when I hear Dreams, that's what I picture.
Dreams was Stevie acknowledging to Lindsay in the lyric, "Now here you go again, you say you want your freedom." And then Lindsay would come back with "Never Going Back Again."
The funny thing was, I don't think we felt that we were necessarily writing such pointed dialogues to each other, Stevie and myself, or Christine to John. I think we thought of it as a more generic approach to writing love songs or songs about emotions that are written about every day. I think it was sort of revealed to us after the fact, you know, when the album came together as a whole, and then there was a reaction from the audience which helped to define that kind of musical soap opera. I mean, we knew the soap opera was there, but we didn't know how clear it was to everyone else.
She broke down and let me in. She
Lindsey never used to want to sing his lyrics. So he'd build these songs and kind of go la da 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 da. And we'd be going, okay, I need some lyrics here. I need our pivot points here. And it finally occurred to me why, because every time he would, Stevie and Lindsey would get in a huge fight. Like never going back again. He waited so long to sing the lyrics that we found out he had recorded all of Never Going Back in the wrong key. And so he went to sing it finally when Stevie wasn't there, and he couldn't, it was in the wrong key, and we had to re-record everything. So that's how kind of far we went to not doing vocals.
Never Going Back Again, he says, you can't ever go back, never go right. But at the end, he turns around and says, come round, see me again. So he blows his whole cover.
Come round, see me again.
Because at the very end of the song, he says, but really, I'd really love it if you'd drop by. See, that's one of the nicest songs he ever wrote about me. Because he actually gave himself away at the end.
Now the vitriol was flying in all directions. How on earth was a band supposed to get through this unscathed? Mick Fleetwood.
Never once did I, as the mother hen of thinking, oh my God, it's all going to blow up and someone's going to walk out and we'll never finish this album, which, believe me, I got calls from Warner Brothers going like, Mick, is it? I said, no, we're doing this. Everyone's managing to come to the Fleetwood Mac party. You know, and we sold our souls to the band, you know.
I'm Paul Sexton, and this is The Story of Rumours on BBC Radio 2. The songs didn't just flow from one writer, as you might think. Whoever had created the piece would bring it into the band to work on.
Loving you isn't the right thing to do.
Go Your Own Way is a good example on any number of levels. I mean, I can remember playing that for the band when we rehearsed, but it wasn't defined in terms of its structure. Now, there's a beat that goes on in the verse. I was trying to cop the beat from Street Fighting Man. Mick, he didn't really, I wouldn't say he didn't want to, but he couldn't really get it in that way. And he made it a little more open and a little more sort of obtuse in the sense that it kind of threw you off. We had that thing almost mixed and ready to go, and at the very 11th hour, I said, you know what, I think we need some kind of counterpart on there in the verse.
If I could, maybe I'd give you my word.
And suddenly I put this thing on, gee, 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 and everyone's going, whoa, where's that been all this time, you know?
You can go your own way.
I mean, it was the finishing touch on the song, and it took from the beginning of the making of Rumours to the very end for that to get fleshed out. That is perhaps an extreme example, but it is certainly typical of the way we were working.
Lindsey, I remember, wanted to mix this really loud, and he always said that this was a song he always wished he could write more of because this is the kind of stuff that he really loved. We mixed that for about 3 days, and remember we were all nearly deaf by the time it was finished. The final mix, I remember coming in late one night, and they said, we've got the final mix, and we played it really loud, and everybody stood there with their hair raised up off their scalps because it sounded so phenomenal.
I wasn't pleased to stand up on stage and have him sing, packing up, shacking up is all she wants to do, because that wasn't true. But it was his only way to lash out at me. It was his only way to hurt me. And I knew that. I knew him so well, and I understood him so well, that I knew what he was doing, and I knew that he really didn't really mean it. So I accepted it. I accepted that he would write songs about me that wouldn't be very nice, and that really, in his heart, he didn't mean it.
Yeah.
Your Own Way. The whole guitar solo at the end was pieced together from about five different guitar parts that Lindsey had done over a period of a couple months looking for genius ideas. And, you know, we could never really get it into one idea, but I was able to use it, riding my faders, the volume controls on the console, bring up one lick and another lick, and fortunately it all went together.
Stevie, Ken, and Christine. Ken Kelly and his co-producer Richard Dasher joked that it felt like they were spending most of their time caught in the crossfire of these warring couples, while all the time having to keep in mind there was an album to record.
It was really tense sometimes. You know, it was on all sides of us. Lindsey usually sat over to my left at the producer's table. He had usually an empty tape box, and he had it filled with, tobacco? You know, and he'd be rolling these cigarettes constantly, like a nervous wreck. And then Christine and Stevie would be behind us, and then over to the right would be Mick and John. And Mick was either going through news of his wife cheating on him, or John was trying to catch Christine's boyfriend sneaking through the studio, and we could see him trying to get in to see Christine, but knowing that he was going to run into John at some point. So, you know, it was tense.
However, recreational cigarettes were not the only enhancement on the menu, so did the band's extracurricular activities make this album even more challenging to complete?
If you change any one of those components that made that record, if I wasn't there, if Richard wasn't there, whatever it was the perfect balance. You know, it was the perfect storm. And you know, the fact that we worked 18 hours a day, 5 weeks in a row straight, you know, at some point, something had to give. And at some point, you go stir-crazy, and you got to pop the bottle of champagne or a beer, marijuana, or some Coke. At some point, you just can't drink coffee. I really don't think it was substance abuse. Really, at that time, it was proportional to what we were doing and how much we were working. I would say that on the following albums, yes. I mean, I remember at the very beginning, the bag of Coke would be left on the control room console. If somebody wanted something, they would ask if it could be brought out to them. I mean, that's really laughable if you know how that whole thing is done. Later on, everybody would have their own stash with them, and they don't necessarily ask anybody for it. So the fact that it was a community bag kind of shows to me that this was just the beginning stages.
Perhaps the most poignant song of all on Rumours was Songbird.
We started that at the record plant in San Francisco. And it was fine, but, you know, the studio's mostly a dead sort of situation. And it was me, actually. I said, I'll tell you what I think we should do, because it has a real atmosphere about it. And how I see you playing this is literally what it gives off to me. I can imagine you singing it in an empty theater.
I had just recently recorded Joni Mitchell's live album, and recently I had been at this place called Berklee Community Theater. So when I was listening to Christine play her demo the second time through, I tried to add some more reverb to make it sound like ambient hall sound, and it just sounded cheesy with putting reverb on the piano. And instantly I just said, you know what we need? We need to go to Berklee Community Theater and record this on a stage on a 9-foot grand. So the rest of the band came in and they went, man, that sounds like a good idea. Let's do it.
It's all right. I know it's right. And the songbirds are singing like they know the score.
There was no audience. We did it in an empty hall. So that gave me the chance to place the best microphones I could throughout the hall and try to capture the ambience of the recording. I ordered the 9-foot grand, and I ordered a set of, I think, 2 dozen roses placed on her piano. And so she walked in, and she kind of like sort of got a tear in her eye, and she just said, "Oh my God, this is so beautiful." And it was a perfect setting.
And I wish you
Silver Springs was written by Stevie Nicks and was originally intended to be on Rumours, but became a B-side to Go Your Own Way.
Silver Springs was supposed to be on the record, but it was, well, their reasons are, it was too long.
You could be my Silver Spring.
And so without asking me or telling me, they recorded I Don't Want to Know and put Silver Springs on the back of Go Your Own Way, which was probably one of the most devastating things anybody has ever done to me in my life. And I remember vividly running out into the middle of the record plant, studio parking lot, and screaming, because I knew that Silver Springs deserved to be on that record and that I Don't Want to Know was really just a really fun guitar song. And Silver Springs is all about me and Lindsay.
So I begin not to love you. Turn around, see me run.
I mean, he didn't write beautiful love songs about me, but I did write some beautiful love songs about him. And I thought it was very unfair that they took that off without even asking me, and then told me after it was done.
Don't say that she's pretty.
I was given the duty of telling her that it's not going on the album, or we were finding it very hard to go on the album, and we'd taken sort of a band vote. To this day, she still grills me about that. You know, well, it never went on, so, you know, I thought it would be great to put it at least on the CD. Because everyone, it's sort of one of those hidden songs that people try to get hold of and can't. But she disallowed it. She said, no, you didn't want it then, so you can't have it now. She put the gun on me.
Stevie wrote that song when her and Lindsay's relationship had finally come to an end.
Weird times, very strange that we were riding a veritable wave, which was wonderful, and yet you'd be backstage. I remember Lindsay just basically having a nervous breakdown. You know, there was his sweetheart of his life next to him, and they weren't together, and just it was pretty heavy.
There were times where I thought, I just can't take the pressure anymore. I just can't get on an airplane and walk by this guy who just gives me this look of death, you know, and says something really nasty to me. When I know that he loves me, and I know that the last thing in the world he wants to do is hurt me, but he can't help it. I should leave this band. But I couldn't. I just couldn't. And I made a promise that I would never be the one that would break up this band.
It was not a bad atmosphere. It never got nasty, but it was just very emotive. We couldn't stop what we were doing as a band, and as individuals, it just seemed that you couldn't stop whatever was going on with your life. It was all on this wave. It was just going forward. It was like a dream state almost.
We'll follow you down to the sound of my voice. We'll
The main songwriters were coming up with quite barbed messages to their respective exes, and you'd think that might make things quite competitive between the writers and former lovers. Christine McVie.
I don't think I ever consciously, I've got to write a song as good as that. I think that our styles are so different that to have a song as good as one of the other guys, you can't really equate because we're so different. So I just went in and wrote songs for me, which I felt were my best, not competing with them in any way, really. That's another one of the beauties of this band, is that we are so different, our writing styles are so different, but yet for some obscure reason seem to link very well one to the other.
So, despite the internal and emotional problems inside Fleetwood Mac, they kept on writing songs. And it was Christine's turn to let her ex, John, know how she was feeling.
He and I were separated, and I was seeing another chappie at that time. His name was Curry Grant. He had a great sense of humour. He was always making me laugh, you know. And I sure needed that at that time. And I recall that I'd written You Make Loving Fun, specifically about him and his wonderful sense of humour.
You Make Loving Fun was to underline how important Christine was to the band, even though her work wasn't always celebrated as much as Stevie and Lindsay's contributions to the album. Here's producer-engineer Ken Kelly.
Songs like You Make Loving Fun and Don't Stop and Oh Daddy, I think she was so important, and she was the glue that held it together. She enabled Stevie to keep her perspective on what was going on, because she was the veteran gal in the group, and Stevie was the new girl, and so I think it couldn't have been done without Christine.
I don't think I could deal with Fleetwood Mac without Chris, because she's very wise, and many, many times when I have been really on a tangent, she has been the one person who has been able to sit down with me and take my hand and say, Stevie, it's going to work out. You're fine. Nothing's wrong. You're not gonna die. When Christine says that, I believe her. When most people say that to me, I don't believe them. I don't say it to them out loud, but in my heart I say, you don't have any idea what it's like to be in this band. You don't have any idea what we've been through. You don't have any idea how we've suffered. And you don't have any idea how hard it has been to keep this whole thing together. But Christine does. So if she says to me, I live, I believe her.
Christine and Stevie were able to take solace from each other when things got bad. But did Lindsay ever have that sort of relationship with John?
John and I were never much of a hang. I mean, I love John a great deal, and we've always respected each other. But we didn't have that really so much.
I'd talk to Stevie, or Stevie would talk to Mick about their situation. Mick would talk to me about Chris, and Chris would talk to Lee. You know, there were no walls up anywhere, because everyone knew what was going on anyway. So whatever anyone could do to help was there if it was needed.
And then as the father figure in all this, Mick Fleetwood.
He has taken on the role of overviewer at various times. I give him especially a lot of credit for keeping the band together during a period where almost every album was a different incarnation. And so you're looking at this series of non sequiturs. You wonder why Mo Austin, who was president of Warner Brothers, kept him on the label for that long. He wasn't really making any money. It's certainly a comment on how the business has changed. You know, a band like that would have been off the label.
Oh, Daddy, You know you make me cry. How can you love me? I don't understand why. Oh, Daddy, if I can make you see, if there's been a fool around, it's got to be me. Yes, it's got to be me. Oh, Daddy, you soothe me with your smile.
Christine McVie.
I think that every song I write has loose connections with someone in this band or has to do with this band in some way or other. Oh, Daddy, I'd written about Jenny and Mick. Jenny and Mick were going through their bad times, as indeed everybody else was. And this was written, so to speak, in the shoes of Jenny, who was at that time really, really sad about the lack of prospect of their marriage surviving. And indeed it didn't.
Why are you right when I'm so wrong? I'm so weak, but you're so strong. Everything you do is just so right. And I can't walk away from you, baby, if I try.
It's amazing. I listen to the songs now, and I'm constantly amazed by the genius that John would be. I mean, some of the lyrics he came up with, like on Oh Daddy, I mean, where does he come up with these whale sounds and things? It's just, he would stand there, even though they were in their own cubicles in the studio, John would be right next to Mick, and John would have a long chord, and he would get out and stand right in front of Mick, and they would just look at each other, and it was like some sort of magic between the two of them.
One thing that was never in doubt about Rumours, and one of the reasons it took off like a rocket, was that all the songs definitely came from the hearts. And just such a song written by Stevie was I Don't Wanna Know.
Well, I wrote that song on guitar in an open tuning one day when he was out. That's one of the few songs I've ever written that wasn't really about anything. You say you love me, but you don't know. You know, it was the fact more that I was playing it on guitar, and it was really fun for me, because by that time I'd started to play piano, and I wasn't playing much on guitar. And Lindsay would leave all his guitars around the house in open, different tunings. So I would, while he was gone, I'd go around and write songs on all of them, and then the next day they'd be changed. And so I would have a little tape recorder, and I would tape them. And Lindsay and the band really liked I Don't Wanna Know. And it took the place of Silver Springs. All my songs, when I finish them, sound pretty country. When they go to whatever bunch of musicians they go to, whether it's Fleetwood Mac or another set of musicians, they decountrify it, which is fine because, I mean, I wanted to be a rock and roll star. I did not start out to be a country singer. We rock and rollers, we code out the sordidness.
Wake up in.
The country people just say, it didn't work, it was terrible, I hated it, and I hate you too. And so I listen to this music, you know, and it makes me die sometimes because I think they are so honest. And I try to be honest, but I am a little bit more Oscar Wilde, Lord Byron-esque. I tend to be a little bit more poetic.
Well, did she make you cry, make you break down, shatter your illusions of love? And is it over now? Do you know how? Pick up the pieces and go home.
Goldust Woman, to me, absolutely sums up what Stevie is all about. She loves the drama of what that song has. There's lots of dynamics, especially when we play it live. There's a lot of dynamics involved in it. She lives those parts. I'm not saying that's how she is all the time, but she's a real performer. Stevie, when she's on stage, is absolutely a certain way, and she loves it. You know, she's a real consummate drama queen, and she really enjoys it. And that particular song, I just think it's very much in character. It's Stevie Nicks with Fleetwood Mac.
There was one song on the album where the entire group had a writing credit. And the hook has probably become one of the most recognisable bridges ever. Here's Mick.
The Chain was one of the last songs that we worked on. In fact, I think it was the last song of a very long year making that album. Lindsay had written a song which musically was pretty much how The Chain turned out. He was having trouble with the words, and Stevie came in one day and just, she'd written some verse, as she often does, and had written The Chain, which is very much about what we'd all been through and all were going through, but also demonstrated the resolve behind it. Keep Us Together was very much summing up what we'd done, and was sort of rather an appropriate last thing to be working on during the making of Rumours.
I remember when Rumours came out, those of us who'd loved the band in all the weird phases it had already been through looked at it and wondered where this new record was going to take them. No one could have known that the answer was the top of the world. Mick Fleetwood has called it the most important album we ever made because its success allowed the group to continue recording as they wanted to, at the pace that suited them. Despite all the pain, all the acrimony, it won the Grammy Award for Album of the Year in 1978, and by then it was already up to about 10 million sales. Now it's way up beyond 30 million and still selling. These are rumours that just go on spreading.
Like our baby, that record, because we went through so much suffering to make it, you know, and the end result was just very moving when you listen to it back to back. We were all kind of singing songs to each other and about each other, and that was such a crisis in our lives, and I think that stands out as just a powerful journal.
After all that, it would have been a killer if you'd sat down and listened to it and gone, God, that sucks. That would really have been a negative. Yeah, it was good. Everyone got excited and started all over again.
It's very hard to know what would have gone on at that time if we hadn't been sort of dysfunctional on a personal level. I certainly do know that it wouldn't have been as successful. because it did bring out the voyeur. People bought into this musical soap opera subtext that was going on, and at some point it did detach from the music, and the success became about the phenomenon.
Yesterday's gone. Yesterday's gone.
Really, Fleetwood Mac did not break up. Really, Lindsay and Stevie broke up, finally, after 12 years. We had our final words, and that was it. We said the final things that you say in a relationship that makes it impossible for you to ever have a relationship again, which is very sad, but very true.
All I want is to see you smile.
To us, it was a challenge that now we are where we are. We've really got to sort of honor that. And we didn't look at it literally like, but that's really what we were doing looking back, and really working hard under emotional duress that is unbelievable that we all got through it, really. But we did.
I'm Paul Sexton, and the story of Rumours was produced by Anna Harrison at Unique for BBC Radio 2.